patients, a series of studies definitively identified the risk factor for a rare and fatal form of lung cancer called mesothelioma. When mesothelioma cases were compared to controls, this cancer appeared to cluster densely in certain professions: insulation installers, firefighters, shipyard workers, heating equipment handlers, and chrysolite miners. As with pot and scrotal cancer, the statistical confluence of a rare profession and a rare tumor swiftly identified the causal agent in this cancer: exposure to asbestos. Tort litigation and federal oversight soon followed, precipitating a reduction in the occupational exposure to asbestos that in turn reduced the risk of mesothelioma. In 1971, yet another such study identified an even more unusual carcinogen, a synthetic hormonal medicine called diethylstilbestrol, DES. DES was widely prescribed to pregnant women in the 1950s to prevent premature deliveries, although it was of only questionable benefit in this regard. A generation later, when women with vaginal and uterine cancer were questioned about their exposures to estrogens, a peculiar pattern emerged. The women had not been exposed to the chemical directly, but their mothers had been. The carcinogen had skipped a generation. It had caused cancers not in the DES-treated women, but in their daughters exposed to the drug in utero. But what if the behavior or exposure responsible for the cancer is completely unknown? What if one did not even know enough about the natural history of mesothelioma or the link between estrogen and vaginal cancer to ask those afflicted about their occupational history or their exposure to asbestos and estrogen? Could carcinogens be discovered a priori? Not by the statistical analysis of cancer-afflicted populations, but by virtue of some intrinsic property of all carcinogens? In the late 1960s, a bacteriologist named Bruce Ames at Berkeley, working on an unrelated problem, stumbled on a test for chemical carcinogens. Ames was studying mutations in Salmonella, a bacterial genus. Salmonella, like any bacteria, possesses genes that allow it to grow under certain conditions. A gene to digest galactose, for instance, is essential for a bacterium to survive on a petri dish where the only sugar source is galactose. Ames observed that mutations in these essential genes could enable or disable the growth of bacteria on a petri dish. A strain of Salmonella normally unable to grow on galactose, say, could acquire a gene mutation that enabled this growth. Once growth enabled, a single bacterium would form a minuscule colony on a petri dish. By counting the number of growth-enabled colonies formed, Ames could quantify the mutation rate in any experiment. Bacteria exposed to a certain substance might produce 6 such colonies, while bacteria exposed to another substance might produce 60. This second substance, in other words, had a 10-fold capacity to initiate changes in genes, or a 10-fold rate of mutation. Ames could now test thousands of chemicals to create a catalog of chemicals that increased the mutation rate, mutagens. And as he populated his catalog, he made a seminal observation. Chemicals that scored as mutagens in his test tended to be carcinogens as well. Dye derivatives, known to be potent human carcinogens, scored floridly, causing hundreds of colonies of bacteria. So did X-rays, benzene compounds, and nitrosiguanidine derivatives, all known to cause cancers in rats and mice. In the tradition of all good tests, Ames's test transformed the unobservable and immeasurable into the observable and measurable. The invisible X-rays that had killed the radium girls in the 1920s could now be seen as revertant colonies on a petri dish. Ames's test was far from perfect. Not every known carcinogen scored in the test. Neither DES nor asbestos sprinkled on the disabled Salmonella caused significant numbers of mutant bacteria. In contrast, chemical constituents of tobacco smoke did cause mutation in the bacteria, as noted by several cigarette manufacturers who ran the test and, finding it disconcertingly positive, quickly buried the results. But despite its shortcomings, the Ames test provided an important link between a purely descriptive approach toward cancer prevention and a mechanistic approach. Carcinogens, Ames suggested, had a common, distinctive, functional property. They altered genes. Ames could not fathom the deeper reason behind this observation. Why was the capacity to cause mutations linked to the ability to induce cancer? But he had demonstrated that carcinogens could be found experimentally, not retrospectively, by investigating cases and controls in human subjects, but by prospectively identifying chemicals that could cause mutations in a rather simple and elegant biological assay. Chemicals, it turned out, were not the only carcinogens, nor was Ames's test the only method to find such agents. In the late 1960s, Baruch Blumberg, a biologist working in Philadelphia, discovered that a chronic, smoldering inflammation caused by a human hepatitis virus could also cause cancer. A biochemistry student at Oxford in the 1950s, Blumberg had become interested in genetic anthropology, the study of genetic variations in human populations. Traditional biological anthropology in the 1950s mainly involved collecting, measuring, and categorizing human anatomical specimens. Blumberg wanted to collect, measure, and categorize human genes, and he wanted to link genetic variations in humans to the susceptibility for diseases. The problem, as Blumberg soon discovered, was the lack of human genes to be measured or categorized. Bacterial genetics was still in its infancy in the 1950s. Even the structure of DNA and the nature of the genes was still largely undiscovered. And human genes had not even been seen or analyzed. The only tangible hint of variations in human genetics came from an incidental observation. Proteins in the blood, called blood antigens, varied between individuals and were inherited in families, thus implying a genetic source for this variation. These blood proteins could be measured and compared across populations using relatively simple tests. Blumberg began to scour far-flung places in the world for blood, drawing tubes of serum from Fulani tribesmen in Africa one month and Basque shepherds the next. In 1964, after a brief tenure at the NIH, he moved to the Institute for Cancer Research in Philadelphia, later renamed the Fox Chase Cancer Center, to systematically organize the variant blood antigens that he had cataloged, hoping to link them to human diseases. It was a curiously inverted approach, like scouring a dictionary for a word and then looking for a crossword puzzle into which that word might fit. One blood antigen that intrigued him was present in several Australian Aboriginal subjects and found frequently in Asian and African populations, but was typically absent in Europeans and Americans. Suspecting that this antigen was the fingerprint of an ancient genetic factor inherited in families, Blumberg called it the Australia antigen, or AU for short. In 1966, Blumberg's lab set out to characterize the Aboriginal antigen in greater detail. He soon noted an odd correlation. Individuals carrying the AU antigen often suffered from chronic hepatitis, an inflammation of the liver. These inflamed livers, studied pathologically, showed signs of chronic cycles of injury and repair. Death of cells in some pockets and compensatory attempts to repair and regenerate liver cells in others, resulting in scarred, shrunken, and burnt-out livers, a condition termed chronic cirrhosis. A link between an ancient antigen and cirrhosis suggested a genetic susceptibility for liver disease, a theory that would have sent Blumberg off on a long and largely fruitless tangent. But a chance incident overturned that theory and radically changed the course of Blumberg's studies. The lab had been following a young patient at a mental disability clinic in New Jersey. Initially, the man had tested negative for the AU antigen. But during one of the serial blood draws in the summer of 1966, his serum suddenly converted from AU negative to AU positive. When his liver function was measured, an acute fulminant hepatitis was discovered. But how could an intrinsic gene cause sudden seroconversion and hepatitis? Genes, after all, do not typically flicker on and off at will. Blumberg's beautiful theory about genetic variation had been slain by an ugly fact. AU, he realized, could not mark an inherent variation in a human gene. In fact, AU was soon found to be neither a human protein nor a blood antigen. AU was a piece of a viral protein floating in the blood, the sign of an infection. The New Jersey man had been infected by this microbe and thus converted from AU negative to positive. Blumberg now raced to isolate the organism responsible for the infection. By the early 1970s, working with a team of collaborators, his lab had purified particles of a new virus, which he called hepatitis B virus, or HBV. The virus was structurally simple, roughly circular, about 42 nanometers in diameter, one of the smallest DNA viruses that infect humans. But the simple structure belied extraordinarily complex behavior. In humans, HBV infection caused a broad spectrum of diseases, ranging from asymptomatic infection to acute hepatitis to chronic cirrhosis in the liver. The identification of a new human virus set off a storm of activity for epidemiologists. By 1969, Japanese researchers, and subsequently Blumberg's group, had learned that the virus was transmitted from one individual to another through blood transfusions. By screening blood before transfusions, using the now familiar AU antigen as one of the early biomarkers in serum, the blood-borne infection could be blocked, thereby reducing the risk of hepatitis B. But another illness soon stood out as linked to HBV, a fatal, insidious form of liver cancer endemic in parts of Asia and Africa that arose out of scarred, ashen livers often decades after chronic viral infection. When cases of hepatocellular cancer were compared to controls using classical statistical methods, chronic infection with HBV and the associated cycle of injury and repair in liver cells stood out as a clear risk factor, at about 5 to 10-fold the risk for uninfected controls. HBV, then, was a carcinogen, although a live carcinogen, capable of being transmitted from one host to another. The discovery of HBV was an embarrassment to the NCI. The Institute's highly targeted and heavily funded Special Virus Cancer Program, having inoculated thousands of monkeys with human cancer extracts, had yet to find a single cancer-associated virus. Yet a genetic anthropologist exploring Aboriginal antigens had found a highly prevalent virus associated with a highly prevalent human cancer. Blumberg was acutely aware of the NCI's embarrassment and of the serendipity in his work. His departure from the NIH in 1964, although cordial, had been driven by precisely such conflicts. His interdisciplinary curiosity had chafed against the discipline-determined rigidity of the constituent institutes, among which the NCI, with its goal-directed cancer virus hunt, was the worst culprit. Worse still, for the strongest enthusiasts of the cancer virus theory, it appeared as if Blumberg's virus itself was not the proximal cause of the cancer. The inflammation induced by the virus in liver cells and the associated cycle of death and repair appeared to be responsible for the cancer, a blow to the notion that viruses directly cause cancer. But Blumberg had little time to mull over these conflicts, and he certainly had no theoretical axes to grind about viruses and cancer. A pragmatist, he directed his team toward finding a vaccine for HBV. By 1979, his group had devised one. Like the blood screening strategy, the vaccine did not, of course, alter the course of the cancer after its genesis, but it sharply reduced the susceptibility to HBV infection in uninfected men and women. Blumberg had thus made a critical link from cause to prevention. He had identified a vital carcinogen, found a method to detect it before transmission, and found a means to thwart transmission. The strangest among the newly discovered preventable carcinogens, though, was not a virus or a chemical, but a cellular organism, a bacterium. In 1979, the year that Blumberg's hepatitis B vaccine was beginning its trial in America, a junior resident in medicine named Barry Marshall and a gastroenterologist, Robin Warren, both at the Royal Perth Hospital in Australia, set out to investigate the cause of stomach inflammation, gastritis, a condition known to predispose patients to peptic ulcers and to stomach cancer. For centuries, gastritis had rather vaguely been attributed to stress and neuroses. In popular use, the term dyspeptic still refers to an irritable and fragile psychological state. By extension, then, cancer of the stomach was cancer unleashed by neurotic stress, in essence, a modern variant of the theory of clogged melancholia proposed by Galen. But Warren had convinced himself that the true cause of gastritis was a yet unknown species of bacteria, an organism that, according to dogma, could not even exist in the inhospitable acidic lumen of the stomach. Since the early days of medical bacteriology, over 100 years ago, Warren wrote, it was taught that bacteria do not grow in the stomach. When I was a student, this was taken as so obvious as to barely rate a mention. It was a known fact, like, everyone knows that the earth is flat. But the flat earth theory of stomach inflammation made little sense to Warren. When he examined biopsies of men and women with gastritis or gastric ulcers, he found a hazy blue layer overlying the crater-like depressions of the ulcers in the stomach. When he looked even harder at that bluish layer, he inevitably saw spiral organisms teeming within it. Or had he imagined it? Warren was convinced that these organisms represented a new species of bacterium that caused gastritis and peptic ulcers. But he could not isolate the bacteria in any form on a plate, dish, or culture. Others could not see the organism. Warren could not grow it. The whole theory, with its blue haze of alien organisms growing above craters in the stomach, smacked of science fiction. Barry Marshall, in contrast, had no pet theory to test or disprove. The son of a Kalgoorlie boilermaker and a nurse, he had trained in medicine in Perth and was an unwetted junior investigator looking for a project. Intrigued by Warren's data, although skeptical of the link with an unknown phantasmic bacteria, he started to collect brushings from patients with ulcers and spread out the material on petri dishes, hoping to grow a bacterium. But as with Warren, no bacteria grew out. Week after week, Marshall's dishes piled up in the incubator and were discarded in large stacks after a few days of examination. But then serendipity intervened. Over an unexpectedly busy Easter weekend in 1982, with the hospital overflowing with medical admissions, Marshall forgot to examine his plates and left them in the incubator. When he remembered and returned to examine them, he found tiny, translucent pearls of bacterial colonies growing on the agar. The long incubation period had been critical. Under the microscope, the bacterium growing on the plate was a minuscule, slow-growing, fragile organism with a helical tail, a species that had never been described by microbiologists. Warren and Marshall called it Helicobacter pylori. Helicobacter for its appearance, and pylorus from the Latin for gatekeeper, for its location near the outlet valve of the stomach. But the mere existence of the bacteria, or even its association with ulcers, was not proof enough that it caused gastritis. Koch's third postulate stipulated that to be classified as a bona fide causal element for a disease, an organism needed to recreate the disease when introduced into a naive host. Marshall and Warren inoculated pigs with the bacteria and performed serial endoscopies. But the pigs, 70 pounds of porcine weight that did not take kindly to weekly endoscopies, did not sprout any ulcers. And testing the theory on humans was ethically impossible. How could one justify infecting a human with a new, uncharacterized species of bacteria to prove that it caused gastritis and predisposed to cancer? In July 1984, with his experiments stalled and his grant applications in jeopardy, Marshall performed the ultimate experiment. On the morning of the experiment, I omitted my breakfast. 2 hours later, Neil Noakes scraped a heavily inoculated 4-day culture plate of Helicobacter and dispersed the bacteria in alkaline peptone water, a kind of meat broth used to keep bacteria alive. I fasted until 10 a.m. when Neil handed me a 200 milliliter beaker about one quarter full of the cloudy brown liquid. I drank it down in one gulp, then fasted for the rest of the day. A few stomach gurgles occurred. Was it the bacteria, or was I just hungry? Marshall was not just hungry. Within a few days of swallowing the turbid bacterial culture, he was violently ill, with nausea, vomiting, night sweats, and chills. He persuaded a colleague to perform serial biopsies to document the pathological changes, and he was diagnosed with highly active gastritis, with a dense overlay of bacteria in his stomach and ulcerating craters beneath, precisely what Warren had found in his patients. In late July, with Warren as co-author, Marshall submitted his own case report to the Medical Journal of Australia for publication. A normal volunteer has swallowed a pure culture of the organism, he wrote. The critics had at last been silenced. Helicobacter pylori was indisputably the cause of gastric inflammation. The link between Helicobacter and gastritis raised the possibility that bacterial infection and chronic inflammation caused stomach cancer. H. pylori infection is linked to several forms of cancer, including gastric adenocarcinoma and mucosa-associated lymphoma. Indeed, by the late 1980s, several epidemiological studies had linked H. pylori-induced gastritis with stomach cancer. Marshall and Warren had, meanwhile, tested antibiotic regimens, including the once-forsaken alchemical agent bismuth, to create a potent multi-drug treatment for the H. pylori infection. Marshall later treated himself with the regimen and eradicated his infection. Randomized trials run on the western coast of Japan, where stomach and H. pylori infection are endemic, show that antibiotic treatment reduced gastric ulcers and gastritis. The effect of antibiotic therapy on cancer, though, was more complex. The eradication of H. pylori infection in young men and women reduced the incidence of gastric cancer. In older patients, in whom chronic gastritis had smoldered for several decades, eradication of the infection had little effect. In these elderly patients, presumably the chronic inflammation had already progressed to a point that its eradication made no difference. For cancer prevention to work, Auerbach's march, the prodrome of cancer, had to be halted early. Although unorthodox in the extreme, Barry Marshall's experiment, swallowing a carcinogen to create a precancerous state in his own stomach, encapsulated a growing sense of impatience and frustration among cancer epidemiologists. Powerful strategies for cancer prevention arise, clearly, from a deep understanding of causes. The identification of a carcinogen is only the first step toward that understanding. To mount a successful strategy against cancer, one needs to know not only what the carcinogen is, but what the carcinogen does. But the set of disparate observations, from Blumberg to Ames to Warren and Marshall, could not simply be stitched together into a coherent theory of carcinogenesis. how could DES, asbestos, radiation, hepatitis virus, and a stomach bacterium all converge on the same pathological state, although in different populations and in different organs? The list of cancer-causing agents seemed to get, as another swallower of unknown potions might have put it, curiouser and curiouser. There was little precedent in other diseases for such an astonishing diversity of causes. Diabetes, a complex illness with complex manifestations, is still fundamentally a disease of abnormal insulin signaling. Coronary heart disease occurs when a clot, arising from a ruptured and inflamed atherosclerotic plaque, occludes a blood vessel of the heart. But the search for a unifying mechanistic description of cancer seemed to be sorely missing. What, beyond abnormal, dysregulated cell division, was the common pathophysiological mechanism underlying cancer? To answer this question, cancer biologists would need to return to the birth of cancer, to the very first steps of a cell's journey toward malignant transformation, to carcinogenesis. A spider's web. It is to earlier diagnosis that we must look for any material improvement in our cancer cures. John Lockhart Mummery, 1926. The greatest need we have today in the human cancer problem, except for a universal cure, is a method of detecting the presence of cancer before there are any clinical signs of symptoms. Sidney Farber, Letter to Etta Rosenson, November 1962. Lady, have you been paptized? New York Amsterdam News, on Pap Smears, 1957. The long, slow march of carcinogenesis, the methodical, step-by-step progression of early-stage lesions of cancer into frankly malignant cells, inspired another strategy to prevent cancer. If cancer truly slouched to its birth, as Auerbach suspected, then perhaps one could still intervene on that progression in its earliest stages, by attacking precancer rather than cancer. Could one thwart the march of carcinogenesis in mid-step? Few scientists have studied this early transition of cancer cells as intensively as George Papanikolaou, a Greek cytologist at Cornell University in New York. Robust, short, formal, and old-worldly, Papanikolaou had trained in medicine and zoology in Athens and in Munich, and arrived in New York in 1913. Penniless off the boat, he had sought a job in a medical laboratory, but had been relegated to selling carpets at the Gimbel store on 33rd Street to survive. After a few months of truly surreal labor, he was, by all accounts, a terrible carpet salesman, Papanikolaou secured a research position at Cornell that may have been just as surreal as carpet selling. He was assigned to study the menstrual cycle of guinea pigs, a species that neither bleeds visibly nor sheds tissue during menses. Using a nasal speculum and Q-tips, Papanikolaou had nonetheless learned to scrape off cervical cells from guinea pigs and spread them on glass slides in thin, watery smears. The cells, he found, were like minute watch hands. As hormones rose and ebbed in the animals cyclically, the cells shed by the guinea pig cervix changed their shapes and sizes cyclically as well. Using their morphology as a guide, he could foretell the precise stage of the menstrual cycle, often down to the day. By the late 1920s, Papanikolaou had extended his technique to human patients. His wife, Maria, in surely one of the more grisly displays of conjugal fortitude, reportedly allowed herself to be tested by cervical smears every day. As with guinea pigs, he found that cells sloughed off by the human cervix could also foretell the stages of the menstrual cycle in women. But all of this, it was pointed out to him, amounted to no more than an elaborate and somewhat useless invention. As one gynecologist archly remarked, in primates, including women, a diagnostic smear was hardly needed to calculate the stage or timing of the menstrual cycle. Women had been timing their periods, without Papanikolaou's cytological help, for centuries. Disheartened by these criticisms, Papanikolaou returned to his slides. He had spent nearly a decade looking obsessively at normal smears. Perhaps, he reasoned, the real value of his test lay not in the normal smear, but in pathological conditions. What if he could diagnose a pathological state with his smear? What if the years of staring at cellular normalcy had merely been a prelude to allow him to identify cellular abnormalities? Papanikolaou thus began to venture into the world of pathological conditions, collecting slides from women with all manners of gynecological diseases, fibroids, cysts, tubercles, inflammations of the uterus and cervix, streptococcal, gonococcal, and staphylococcal infections, tubal pregnancies, abnormal pregnancies, benign and malignant tumors, abscesses and furuncles, hoping to find some pathological mark in the exfoliated cells. Cancer, he found, was particularly prone to shedding abnormal cells. In nearly every case of cervical cancer, when Papanikolaou brushed cells off the cervix, he found aberrant and bizarre forms, with abnormal bloated nuclei, ruffled membranes, and shrunken cytoplasm that looked nothing like normal cells. It became readily apparent, he wrote, that he had stumbled on a new test for malignant cells. Thrilled by his results, Papanikolaou published his method in an article entitled New Cancer Diagnosis in 1928. But the report, presented initially at an outlandish race betterment eugenics conference, generated only further condescension from pathologists. The pap smear, as he called the technique, was neither accurate nor particularly sensitive. If cervical cancer was to be diagnosed, his colleagues argued, then why not perform a biopsy of the cervix, a meticulous procedure that, even if cumbersome and invasive, was considered far more precise and definitive than a grubby smear. At academic conferences, experts scoffed at the crude alternative. Even Papanikolaou could hardly argue the point. "I think this work will be carried a little further," he wrote self-deprecatingly at the end of his 1928 paper. Then, for nearly two decades, having produced two perfectly useless inventions over 20 years, he virtually disappeared from the scientific limelight. Between 1928 and 1950, Papanikolaou delved back into his smears with nearly monastic ferocity. His world involuted into a series of routines, the daily half-hour commute to his office with Maria at the wheel, the weekends at home in Long Island with a microscope in the study and a microscope on the porch, evenings spent typing reports on specimens with a phonograph playing Schubert in the background and a glass of orange juice congealing on his table. A gynecologist pathologist named Herbert Trout joined him to help interpret his smears. A Japanese fish and bird painter named Hashimi Murayama, a colleague from his early years at Cornell, was hired to paint watercolors of his smears using a camera lucida. For Papanikolaou, too, this brooding contemplative period was like a personal camera lucida that magnified and reflected old experimental themes onto new ones. A decades-old thought returned to haunt him. If normal cells of the cervix changed morphologically in graded, stepwise fashion over time, might cancer cells also change morphologically in time, in a slow, stepwise dance from normal to malignant? Like Auerbach, whose work was yet to be published, could he identify intermediate stages of cancer, lesions slouching their way toward full transformation? At a Christmas party in the winter of 1950, challenged by a tipsy young gynecologist in his lab to pinpoint the precise use of the smear, Papanikolaou verbalized a strand of thought that he had been spinning internally for nearly a decade. The thought almost convulsed out of him. The real use of the pap smear was not to find cancer, but rather to detect its antecedent, its precursor, the portent of cancer. It was a revelation, one of his students recalled. A pap smear would give a woman a chance to receive preventive care and greatly decrease the likelihood of her ever developing cancer. Cervical cancer typically arises in an outer layer of the cervix, then grows in a flaky, superficial whorl before burrowing inward into the surrounding tissues. By sampling asymptomatic women, Papanikolaou speculated that his test, albeit imperfect, might capture the disease at its first stages. He would, in essence, push the diagnostic clock backward from incurable invasive cancers to curable pre-invasive malignancies. In 1952, Papanikolaou convinced the National Cancer Institute to launch the largest clinical trial of secondary prevention in the history of cancer, using his smearing technique. Nearly every adult female resident of Shelby County, Tennessee, 150,000 women spread across 800 square miles, was tested with a pap smear and followed over time. Smears poured in from hundreds of sites, from one-room doctor's offices dotted among the horse farms of Germantown to large urban community clinics scattered throughout the city of Memphis. Temporary pap clinics were set up in factories and office buildings. Once collected, the samples were funneled into a gigantic microscope facility at the University of Tennessee, where framed photographs of exemplary normal and abnormal smears had been hung on the walls. Technicians read slides day and night, looking up from the microscopes at the pictures. At the peak, nearly 1,000 smears were read every day. As expected, the Shelby team found its fair share of advanced cancerous lesions in the population. In the initial cohort of about 150,000, invasive cervical cancer was found in 555 women. But the real proof of Papanikolaou's principle lay in another discovery. Astonishingly, 557 women were found to have pre-invasive cancers or even precancerous changes, early-stage localized lesions curable by relatively simple surgical procedures. Nearly all these women were asymptomatic. Had they never been tested, they would never have been suspected of harboring pre-invasive lesions. Notably, the average age of diagnosis of women with such pre-invasive lesions was about 20 years lower than the average age of women with invasive lesions, once again corroborating the long march of carcinogenesis. The pap smear had, in effect, pushed the clock of cancer detection forward by nearly two decades and changed the spectrum of cervical cancer from predominantly incurable to predominantly curable. A few miles from Papanikolaou's laboratory in New York, the core logic of the pap smear was being extended to a very different form of cancer. Epidemiologists think about prevention in two forms. In primary prevention, a disease is prevented by attacking its cause, smoking cessation for lung cancer, or a vaccine against hepatitis B for liver cancer. In secondary prevention, also called screening, a disease is prevented by screening for its early pre-symptomatic stage. The pap smear was invented as a means of secondary prevention for cervical cancer. But if a microscope could detect a pre-symptomatic state in scraped-off cervical tissue, then could another means of seeing cancer detect an early lesion in another cancer-afflicted organ? In 1913, a Berlin surgeon named Albert Salomon had certainly tried. A dogged, relentless champion of the mastectomy, Salomon had whisked away nearly 3,000 amputated breasts after mastectomies to an X-ray room, where he had photographed them after surgery to detect the shadowy outlines of cancer. Salomon had detected stigmata of cancer in his X-rays, microscopic sprinkles of calcium lodged in cancer tissue, grains of salt, as later radiologists would call them, or thin crustacean fingerlings of malignant cells reminiscent of the root of the word cancer. The next natural step might have been to image breasts before surgery as a screening method, but Salomon's studies were rudely interrupted. Abruptly purged from his university position by the Nazis in the mid-1930s, Solomon escaped the camps to Amsterdam and vanished underground, and so too did his shadowy X-rays of breasts. Mammography, as Solomon called his technique, languished in neglect. It was hardly missed. In a world obsessed with radical surgery, since small or large masses in the breast were treated with precisely the same gargantuan operation, screening for small lesions made little sense. For nearly two decades, the mammogram thus lurked about in the far peripheries of medicine, in France and England and Uruguay, places where radical surgery held the least influence. But by the mid-1960s, with Halstead's theory teetering uneasily on its pedestal, mammography re-entered X-ray clinics in America, championed by pioneering radiographers such as Robert Egan in Houston. Egan, like Papanicolaou, cast himself more as an immaculate craftsman than a scientist, a photographer, really, who was taking photographs of cancer using X-rays, the most penetrating form of light. He tinkered with films, angles, positions, and exposures, until, as one observer put it, trabeculae as thin as a spider's web in the breast could be seen in the images. But could cancer be caught in that spider's web of shadows, trapped early enough to prevent its spread? Egan's mammograms could now detect tumors as small as a few millimeters, about the size of a grain of barley. But would screening women to detect such early tumors and extricating the tumors surgically save lives? Screening trials in cancer are among the most slippery of all clinical trials, notoriously difficult to run, and notoriously susceptible to errors. To understand why, consider the odyssey from the laboratory to the clinic of a screening test for cancer. Suppose a new test has been invented in the laboratory to detect an early pre-symptomatic stage of a particular form of cancer, say the level of a protein secreted by cancer cells into the serum. The first challenge of such a test is technical, its performance in the real world. Epidemiologists think of screening tests as possessing two characteristic performance errors. The first error is overdiagnosis, when an individual tests positive in the test but does not have cancer. Such individuals are called false positives. Men and women who falsely test positive find themselves trapped in the punitive stigma of cancer, the familiar cycle of anxiety and terror, and the desire to do something that precipitates further testing and invasive treatment. The mirror image of overdiagnosis is underdiagnosis, an error in which a patient truly has cancer but does not test positive for it. Underdiagnosis falsely reassures patients of their freedom from disease. These men and women, false negatives in the jargon of epidemiology, enter a different punitive cycle of despair, shock, and betrayal once their disease, undetected by the screening test, is eventually uncovered when it becomes symptomatic. The trouble is that overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis are often intrinsically conjoined, locked perpetually on two ends of a seesaw. Screening tests that strive to limit overdiagnosis by narrowing the criteria by which patients are classified as positive often pay the price of increasing underdiagnosis because they miss patients that lie in the gray zone between positive and negative. An example helps to illustrate this trade-off. Suppose, to use Egan's vivid metaphor, a spider is trying to invent a perfect web to capture flies out of the air. Increasing the density of that web, she finds, certainly increases the chances of catching real flies, true positives, but it also increases the chances of capturing junk and debris floating through the air, false positives. Making the web less dense, in contrast, decreases the chance of catching real prey, but every time something is captured, chances are higher that it is a fly. In cancer, where both overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis come at high costs, finding that exquisite balance is often impossible. We want every cancer test to operate with perfect specificity and sensitivity. But the technologies for screening are not perfect. Screening tests thus routinely fail because they cannot even cross this preliminary hurdle. The rate of over- or under-diagnosis is unacceptably high. Suppose, however, our new test does survive this crucial bottleneck. The rates of over-diagnosis and under-diagnosis are deemed acceptable, and we unveil the test on a population of eager volunteers. Suppose, moreover, that as the test enters the public domain, doctors immediately begin to detect early, benign-appearing, pre-malignant lesions, in stark contrast to the aggressive, fast-growing tumors seen before the test. Is the test to be judged a success? No. Merely detecting a small tumor is not sufficient. Cancer demonstrates a spectrum of behavior. Some tumors are inherently benign, genetically determined to never reach the fully malignant state, and some tumors are intrinsically aggressive, and intervention at even an early pre-symptomatic stage might make no difference to the prognosis of a patient. To address the inherent behavioral heterogeneity of cancer, the screening test must go further. It must increase survival. Imagine now that we have designed a trial to determine whether our screening test increases survival. Two identical twins, call them Hope and Prudence, live in neighboring houses and are offered the trial. Hope chooses to be screened by the test. Prudence, suspicious of overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis, refuses to be screened. Unbeknownst to Hope and Prudence, identical forms of cancer develop in both twins at the exact same time, in 1990. Hope's tumor is detected by the screening test in 1995, and she undergoes surgical treatment and chemotherapy. She survives 5 additional years, then relapses and dies 10 years after her original diagnosis, in 2000. Prudence, in contrast, detects her tumor only when she feels a growing lump in her breast in 1999. She too has treatment, with some marginal benefit, then relapses and dies at the same moment as Hope in 2000. At the joint funeral, as the mourners stream by the identical caskets, an argument breaks out among Hope's and Prudence's doctors. Hope's physicians insist that she had a 5-year survival. Her tumor was detected in 1995, and she died in 2000. Prudence's doctors insist that her survival was 1 year. Prudence's tumor was detected in 1999, and she died in 2000. Yet both cannot be right. The twins died from the same tumor at the exact same time. The solution to this seeming paradox, called lead time bias, is immediately obvious. Using survival as an endpoint for a screening test is flawed because early detection pushes the clock of diagnosis backward. Hope's tumor and Prudence's tumor possess exactly identical biological behavior. But since doctors detected Hope's tumor earlier, it seems, falsely, that she lived longer and that the screening test was beneficial. So our test must now cross an additional hurdle. It must improve mortality, not survival. The only appropriate way to judge whether Hope's test was truly beneficial is to ask whether Hope lived longer, regardless of the time of her diagnosis. Had Hope lived until 2010, outliving Prudence by a decade, we could have legitimately ascribed a benefit to the test. Since both women died at the exact same moment, we now discover that screening produced no benefit. A screening test's path to success is thus surprisingly long and narrow. It must avoid the pitfalls of overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis. It must steer past the narrow temptation to use early detection as an end in itself. Then it must navigate the treacherous straits of bias and selection. Survival, seductively simple, cannot be its endpoint. and adequate randomization at each step is critical. Only a test capable of meeting all these criteria, proving mortality benefit in a genuinely randomized setting with an acceptable over and under diagnosis rate, can be judged a success. With the odds stacked so steeply, few tests are powerful enough to withstand this level of scrutiny and truly provide benefit in cancer. In the winter of 1963, three men set out to test whether screening a large cohort of asymptomatic women using mammography would prevent mortality from breast cancer. All three, outcasts from their respective fields, were seeking new ways to study breast cancer. Louis Vinet, a surgeon trained in the classical tradition, wanted to capture early cancers as a means to avert the large and disfiguring radical surgeries that had become the norm in the field. Sam Shapiro, a statistician, sought to invent new methods to mount statistical trials. And Philip Strax, a New York internist, had perhaps the most poignant of reasons. He had nursed his wife through the torturous terminal stages of breast cancer in the mid-1950s. Strax's attempt to capture pre-invasive lesions using X-rays was a personal crusade to unwind the biological clock that had ultimately taken his wife's life. Vinet, Strax, and Shapiro were sophisticated clinical trialists. Right at the onset, they realized that they would need a randomized prospective trial using mortality as an endpoint to test mammography. Methodologically speaking, their trial would recapitulate Dahl and Hill's famous smoking trial of the 1950s. But how might such a trial be logistically run? The Dahl and Hill study had been the fortuitous byproduct of the nationalization of healthcare in Great Britain. Its stable cohort produced in large part by the National Health Service's address book of registered doctors across the United Kingdom. For mammography, in contrast, it was the sweeping wave of privatization in post-war America that provided the opportunity to run the trial. In the summer of 1944, lawmakers in New York unveiled a novel program to provide subscriber-based health insurance to groups of employees in New York. This program, called the Health Insurance Plan, HIP, was the ancestor of the modern HMO. The HIP filled a great void in insurance. By the mid-1950s, a triad of forces, immigration, World War II, and the Depression, had brought women out of their homes to comprise nearly one-third of the total workforce in New York. These working women sought health insurance, and the HIP, which allowed its enrollees to pool risks and thereby reduce costs, was a natural solution. By the early 1960s, the plan had enrolled more than 300,000 subscribers spread across 31 medical groups in New York, nearly 80,000 of them women. Strax, Shapiro, and Vinet were quick to identify the importance of the resource. Here was a defined, captive cohort of women spread across New York and its suburbs that could be screened and followed over a prolonged time. The trial was kept deliberately simple. Women enrollees in the HIP between the ages of 40 and 64 were divided into two groups. One group was screened with mammography, while the other was left unscreened. The ethical standards for screening trials in the 1960s made the identification of the groups even simpler. The unscreened group, i.e., the one not offered mammography, was not even required to give consent. It could just be enrolled passively in the trial and followed over time. The trial, launched in December 1963, was instantly a logistic nightmare. Mammography was cumbersome, a machine the size of a full-grown bull, photographic plates like small window panes, the slosh and froth of toxic chemicals in a darkroom. The technique was best performed in dedicated X-ray clinics, but unable to convince women to travel to these clinics, many of them located uptown, Strax and Vinet eventually outfitted a mobile van with an X-ray machine and parked it in Midtown Manhattan, alongside the ice cream trucks and sandwich vendors, to recruit women into the study during lunch breaks. In addition to mammography, women also received a breast exam, typically performed by a surgeon. Strax began an obsessive campaign of recruitment. When a subject refused to join the study, he would call, write, and call her again to persuade her to join. The clinics were honed to a machine-like precision to allow thousands of women to be screened in a day. Interview. 5 stations times 12 women per hour equals 60 women. Undress dress cubicles. 16 cubicles times 6 women per hour equals 96 women per hour. Each cubicle provides 1 square of floor space for dress-undress and contains 4 clothes lockers for a total of 64. At the close of the circle, the woman enters the same cubicle to obtain her clothes and dress. To expedite turnover, the amenities of chairs and mirrors are omitted. Curtains rose and fell. Closets opened and closed. Chairless and mirrorless rooms let women in and out. The merry-go-round ran through the day and late into the evening. In an astonishing span of 6 years, the trio completed a screening that would ordinarily have taken 2 decades to complete. If a tumor was detected by mammography, the woman was treated according to the conventional intervention available at the time, surgery, typically a radical mastectomy, to remove the mass, or surgery followed by radiation. Once the cycle of screening and intervention had been completed, Strax, Benet, and Shapiro could watch the experiment unfold over time by measuring breast cancer mortality in the screened versus unscreened groups. In 1971, 8 years after the study had been launched, Strax, Benet, and Shapiro revealed the initial findings of the HIP trial. At first glance, it seemed like a resounding vindication of screening. 62,000 women had been enrolled in the trial. About half had been screened by mammography. There had been 31 deaths in the mammography-screened group and 52 deaths in the control group. The absolute number of lives saved was admittedly modest, but the fractional reduction in mortality from screening, almost 40%, was remarkable. Strax was ecstatic. "The radiologist," he wrote, "has become a potential savior of women and their breasts." The positive results of the HIP trial had an explosive effect on mammography. Within 5 years, mammography has moved from the realm of a discarded procedure to the threshold of widespread application, a radiologist wrote. At the National Cancer Institute, enthusiasm for screening rose swiftly to a crescendo. Arthur Holub, the American Cancer Society's chief medical officer, was quick to note the parallel to the pap smear. "The time has come," Holub announced in 1971, "for the Society to mount a massive program on mammography, just as we did with the pap test. No longer can we ask the people of this country to tolerate a loss of life from breast cancer each year equal to the loss of life in the past 10 years in Vietnam. The time has come for greater national effort. I firmly believe that time is now." The ACS's massive campaign was called the Breast Cancer Detection and Demonstration Project, BCDDP. Notably, this was not a trial, but, as its name suggested, a demonstration. There was no treatment or control group. The project intended to screen nearly 250,000 women in a single year, nearly 8 times the number screened by Strax in 3 years, in large part to show that it was possible to muscle through mammographic screenings at a national level. Mary Lasker backed it strongly, as did virtually every cancer organization in America. Mammography, the discarded procedure, was about to become enshrined in the mainstream. But even as the BCDDP forged ahead, doubts were gathering over the HIP study. Shapiro, recall, had chosen to randomize the trial by placing the test women and control women into 2 groups and comparing mortality. But as was common practice in the 60s, the control group had not been informed of its participation in a trial. It had been a virtual group, a cohort drawn out of the HIP's records. When a woman had died of breast cancer in the control group, Strax and Shapiro had dutifully updated their ledgers, but, trees falling in statistical forests, the group had been treated as an abstract entity, unaware even of its own existence. In principle, comparing a virtual group